So at this point, we've worked our way through an introduction to methods, and we're working our way through an introduction to statistics. And I hope you're starting to see why we teach them together, because we have to know where the data came from in order to analyze it and answer the kind of questions. In fact, we should frame the way we get our data in order to maximize the statistical analyses and answering the questions that we want to do. It starts with simple things like, is something going to be a variable or a constant in our study? And if it's going to be a variable, how are we going to deal with it? Are we going to measure it, or are we going to manipulate it? And for either of those, is it going to be qualitative or quantitative? Hey, bud. All of that stuff matters when we get to now, which is analyzing the data. This is a game, you've heard me say this before, this is a game of representation and inference. Without the representation, the inference isn't anything. That's one of the challenges of secondary data sets, archival data sets. Someone else collected the data the way they wanted, and you're stuck with it. But it is still an opportunity, and I want to play up the opportunity, especially for young scientists with no budget, of working with secondary data sets. They're all over the place. There's secondary data sets in the labs that you're in now. There's secondary data sets in the drawers of the faculty that you work with. And if you can do something like homework 3, where you take a bunch of data and ask, what questions can we ask out of this? You can pick the right statistical model and you can start telling stories about how those variables relate to each other. You may discover something that wasn't found in the original analyses. And when you can find something that wasn't in the original analysis, that's your entree to a discussion. Sometimes it's enough for a conference or a research project for a course or some other requirement for your program. Keep in mind, all of this stuff is research. Find ways to do things that other people haven't thought of doing yet. The stuff we're going to talk about today and Friday is designed to add a layer to what is normally studied in a stats class. Correlation, chi-square, and a couple of ANOVAs. What else is there? How can we make analyzing those better? Another part of today is to recognize that, as we've talked about before, there's three kinds of things in the world. There's math, where there's only one answer because it's math. There's deeply held conventions, and there's competing conventions. Today we're going to look at some of both of the latter two. Because at this point we're talking about statistical inference. It's not math, it's tool use. It's taste and style and art and craft and doing things with our data analyses that get us as close as possible to the question that we want to ask of our data. Now I say things like that and you look at me funny. What do you mean get as close as possible? As we move into more advanced statistical models, you're going to see that sometimes what the statistics do and what our questions are don't quite match. And so we have to make sure that we're asking the best possible analysis. We already have seen one good example of that. I've got two quantitative variables. I've got how well people did on exam 1 and how well people did on exam 2, and I want to understand how those variables relate to each other. We already know two different things we can do. We can ask if they're correlated. Does your score on exam 1 predict your score on exam 2? Different from that, we can ask, instead of a question about individuals, we can ask questions about the group. Did the group do better on exam 1 than exam 2? Those are different questions, and we drew up on the board trying to show you that they're independent of each other. You can get a positive 0 or a negative correlation and a greater than, equal to, less than mean difference in any combination. Some are more common than others. The most common situation there is a positive correlation, doing better on the second exam. But there's not a guarantee. We also know something that was sort of annoying on homework 1, which is taking that quantitative variable and breaking it into ordered categories. But remember, that allows us to move back and forth between a variable, treating a variable as quantitative and part of a continuum, and treating a variable as categorical, because there's a lot of categorical things in our world. Pass, fail, guilty, not guilty. higher, not higher. And we can take quantitative variables, turn them into categorical variables, and do chi-squares. We can take one of two variables, turn it into a categorical variable, and do ANOVAs. Just those small things can give you a richer version of your results. If I want to know whether this treatment does better, this particular teaching technique I'm working on does better, I literally get different results if I just compare means, if I just compare correlations with things, and if I look at A's versus B's, B's versus C's, C's versus D's, and D's versus fail. Depending upon where I cut off that continuum, put it into different categories, and which categories I look at, I get a different answer. Listen to that. I get a different answer about whether a treatment works. That should make you go, oh. Because it's those kinds of options, it's those kind of opportunities, it's those kinds of data manipulation things. Data manipulation is not a bad word. Lying and cheating and stealing are bad words. Manipulation is not a bad word. But that sort of data manipulation to reframe the data to get to the question you want to ask as directly as possible is good. I remember when I went to one of my first teaching conferences when I was, punk kid. And what I did instead of doing a mean difference is I showed the proportion of A's, B's, C's, and D's in the two different classes. And I didn't get much of a mean difference. Because it turns out that that particular technique drove A students nuts, but it saved people who were failing. So we got this little bit of collapsing to the middle. And so it tells you that this is a tremendous remediation technique, but don't use it in advanced and honors classes. Same data. Just a different way of treating it, being able to treat it as a qualitative variable and do a chi-square instead of wedging everything into a quantitative variable and an ANOVA. This is what I want for you. I want you thinking about where the data come from, what the data mean, what's the most direct test of the questions you started with, and what other questions can you pull out of these data? Round two of the ongoing soapbox. Remember, we are not about P less than 0.05. That's not the goal. The goal is not P less than 0.05. It's hard to remember that because it's one of the first things that we hung on to and called statistics, and it's there waiting for us in every printout, and it should. And then the really harder one. We're not here to support our research hypotheses. We're here to get it right. And the way to get it right means you got to get it right twice in a row. You have to come up with a research hypothesis that is accurate. And then you have to appropriately and meaningfully support it with your data. Statistical conclusion validity is our goal. Not smiley face. Statistical conclusion validity. The hope is that by understanding these three techniques, you're going to do a little better at statistical conclusion validity, because knowing these techniques will at least add information to your analyses and maybe even save your ass, because it lets you know when an analysis has gone sideways. So, questions about stuff. I made you something. I made you a Q2 Blue Things that has a demo and a couple of practices. The demo is like the other demo. It tells you what the components are. It has Marvins that go over things. It has Boldface that draws your attention to things. And it is exact layout of the practices and the final quizzes. One thing I want to start saying, and I have to check on this, but I'm going to say it anyway just in case. It used to be, and may still be, that when you go to the DLC and you're going to take the quiz, you have to use Firefox as your browser. The reason for that is, in order to facilitate this, you're going to download a power table, like we're going to learn how to use today and Friday. You're going to download a power table, and you're also going to download the Excel computator for calculating effect sizes. In order to download those in their environment, you have to be in a particular browser. Now, I'm going to call Amy and check on that, and if the rules have changed, I'll keep some. Whatever is true, I'll continue to say whatever I think is true. There's an interesting statement. All right. The no hypothesis significance testing controversy. Should we be doing this, and or should we be doing this differently? I want to point out that the first published condemnation of no hypothesis significance testing was published before the first published use of null hypothesis significance testing. That's a controversy. Something's not even out of the gate yet, and somebody's unhappy with it. As long as there has been null hypothesis significance testing, there's been an ongoing dialogue. You know me, I like to put quotes around things that are strange characterizations. About its sensibility and utility. Is it a good idea? And if it's a good idea, does it even work? Recently, this discussion has been elevated to a controversy. One of the things that makes something a controversy is one or more important groups, say, form a committee to evaluate it and then give advice to their members. And when two or three of those are going on at the same time and they're not agreeing, I'm going to call that a controversy. Because we're getting advice, sometimes at the level of what journal you want to publish in. There's basically three sides. You know me, I like lists, I prefer short lists. There's basically three arguments. One is, fucking quit. Don't do it, never worked, was never a good idea, do something else, damn it. Retain it as the centerpiece, we're fine. Everything's fine. And do better. Use it as the heart, but do better. So basically, dump it, fix it, keep it. Sounds like junior high school dating. There's also the controversies everywhere. There's stuff everywhere. I have a book, I think it's probably my favorite book out of the 90s version of this controversy. The title of the book was, What If There Was No Significance Test? And the editor sort of sometimes managed to continue it as kind of a fairy tale. What if there were? What would we do? It was kind of fun. All right, so ban the null hypothesis significance test. The nil null is silly and never really expected. Nil null might not be a phrase that you've heard before. But the nulls that you've been working with, particularly in here, are nil nulls because the null is always expressed as some kind of zero. Nil, zero, get it? All right. The real question is not whether there's a relationship, but whether it is large enough to care about or invest in. Here's the counter to that. The counter is, and you've heard this before because we've been getting ready for this part of the slide for a couple of weeks. We know we live in a complex multi-causal world. Our first concern about multi-causality was worrying about confounds. I want to say that this causes that, and I've got all this other shit going on. So I need an experiment that is so beautifully and tightly run that these variables, which I can sort into subject variables related to initial equivalence and procedural variables related to ongoing equivalence, are all cleaned up. And the only thing left is these two. I manipulated this before I measured that, so I have temporal precedence. They're related, and because none of these other things are operating, I can say they're causally related. Now, we think about doing that two variables at a time, IV, DV. But we know there's all this other stuff. Then we start thinking about multi-causality as things happen in a chain of events. That A causes B, and A and B influence C, and A, B, and C influence D. And we'll look at models for that called path analyses in the spring. The idea is that because of multi-causality, whether you're worrying about it from a controlled perspective or a statistical perspective, bivariate relationships aren't necessarily going to be very strong. Because a bivariate relationship is just part of the causal picture. And if a variable has 15 causes, you can't expect any one of them to be Mondo. And so, people argue, the nil-null hypothesis test is not that silly, because sometimes we really are interested in whether or not. And when you move into more fancier, more sophisticated statistical models, the first thing that happens usually is specification. Which variables do you keep and which variables do you throw out of the model? If it helps, we need to keep it in there. If it doesn't, we throw it out. It's just the multivariate version of the same thing. So the nil-null hypothesis test is not all that goofy. Null hypothesis significance testing has been used so poorly that we should scrap it and replace it with appropriate statistical analyses. This was a phrase you saw over and over and over again. And it was kind of like when somebody says, we need to imagine new, finish the sentence yourself. Telling me I need to come up with something else is not the same thing as giving me something to use. We're data analysts. We're practitioners. We're theorists. We're trying to model data to solve questions and answer problems. Bring me a tool that works better. Show me how to use it and get out of my way. What should we do? We need to, at a minimum, add effect size estimates and confidence intervals. Null hypothesis significance testing should be part of the story. Is the relationship in the sample strong enough to conclude there's a relationship in a population? Cool. How big might that effect be? And what are the interpretations of different sizes of effects? Keep it, but do better. The first element of keep it, but do better really does need to be power analysis. A power analysis is part of two different things. There's two kinds of power analyses. There's an a priori power analysis that is used to decide how large should our sample be so that we have how much of a chance of rejecting the null. There's also post hoc power analysis. Remember when I told you before that statistical analyses have two basic goals? One is standardization and the other is error estimation. If we're going to make a decision, it'd be nice if we all started in the same place and ended up in the same place. That's what I mean by standardization. That we all reach the same conclusion with the same data. The other thing is error estimation. You're about to make a decision. Wouldn't it be awesome if some quiet whisper leaned over your shoulder and said, you're about to fuck this up. There's a 30% chance that you're about to make a mistake. Wouldn't that be awesome? Well, that's what a p-value is for one kind of mistake. One kind of mistake is a type 1 error, a false alarm, concluding there's a relationship in the population when there really isn't. And a p-value is an estimate of that. It's not a calculation of that, and it's not the only way to estimate it, but it is an estimate of that. It's an estimate of the likelihood that if you reject the null based on these data, you're about to make a type 1 error. Well, we have another kind of error that we worry about too, type 2 errors. And a power analysis is part of estimating a type 2 error. If you're about to retain the null, you might be screwing up. We don't just make mistakes rejecting the null. We also make mistakes retaining the null, a type 2 error. And we want to be able to estimate that as well. In fact, the interplay of a priori and post hoc power analyses are put together in a presentation that Jim Butcher did years and years ago to APA, where he stood up there and he said 64% of the time we're wrong. And everybody went, what? Jim, brother, what the hell? 5% of this is the type 1 error. 59% is type 2 errors. Jim was pushing meta-analyses at the time and did some awesome ones. And one of the ones that he did is he looked at in his area and in the kind of social psychology that he studied, he figured out what was the typical effect size. And he looked and he figured out what was the typical sample size. And if you look for the typical effect size with the typical sample size, you have about 40% power and about a 60% chance of missing an effect and making a type 2 error. It's actually 59, but yeah. Most of the mistakes that we make are type 2 errors, not type 1 errors. We didn't name them because of their prevalence. We named them because of how much we hate them. We hate false alarms. They cause more problems. They are historically a bigger problem for thinking human beings. So, we really want to be able to do power analyses, first of all, to avoid type 2 errors, and if we're about to retain a null, to estimate the probability of a type 2 error. Because we really would like to know, just before we make a decision, what the chances we're about to screw this up. Also, the effect size. Understand what we've done. So this is, we're going to use correlation as an example, and correlation isn't really normally distributed, but I only have one thing I can draw, and that's it. Notice what we do. Right? And then, remember the bad old days of doing things by hands, where you would calculate an R, and then you would go to the table and you would look up an R critical. And that R critical is based on the sample size, or the degrees of freedom minus 2. And you would draw a line, let's say it is 0.64. -0.64. What we're doing when we do a significance test is we're saying all of that's zero. This is positive, this is negative. And as I'm sure you remember, this sucker slides around based on the sample size. Because smaller effects are more believable with larger samples. Track through that. Smaller effects are more believable with large samples. So if I've got a sample of that's small, I may need a 0.5 to be significant. If it's large, I may need a 0.1. So while we're making that decision and while we allow ourselves to pick whatever sample size we want, maybe we should be paying attention to what the estimate of the effect size is along with the decision of whether it's positive, zero, or negative. Okay? And I'll show you examples. Now, this sets the stage for saying something that I'm going to say over and over and over again because I want to change your habit. We will evaluate the replication of studies by looking at the effect size, not the p-value. We will look at the replication of studies by looking at the effect size, not the p-value. Why? Because it works better. R is not dramatically influenced by the sample size. R is built that way. R is designed that unlike F and unlike chi-square and a whole bunch of other things, the summary statistic R is not massively influenced by sample size. I'm not going to tell you there are no results, but most of those results have to do with sampling adequacy and representation, not N per se. Whereas in chi-square and F, number per se changes F and chi-square. So, we, in addition to deciding plus, zero, or negative, want to know, so how big is it? When I was in graduate school, the classic question on comps was, you have run four studies, all finding a correlation of 0.4 that was not statistically significant. what's your best estimate of the population correlation? 0.4 or 0? Oh, I see what you're doing here. I keep getting a 0.4, but the sample size is small enough that it's not significantly different from 0. So when it comes right down to it, on what do I bet the farm? That there is a positive correlation or that there isn't? Notice, there's a disconnect. The correlation seems big enough to be impressive and useful and wonderful, but it's not significant. We have to notice when we have disconnects. And the hope of power analyses is to end those disconnects because we have a big enough sample. And to notice when we have a disconnect, because when we're about to retain the null, we can stop and ask, so is this like a 5% risk or a 700,000% risk? That's, you know, dramatization. And confidence intervals. At one point, there were actually suggestions to do away with all significance tests and just do confidence intervals. Now, I like confidence intervals. Confidence intervals give you more information than is in a significance test. That makes them useful right away. A confidence interval tells you everything that's in a significance test, and it gives you some more information. It gives you two other kinds of information that I value, so I'm going to pitch this hard. The problem with confidence intervals is they're a very simple statistic that address a very simple statistical question. And if you're doing big, ugly statistical questions, you have piles of confidence intervals in order to tell a story. And those piles can be inhibitive. Non-nil hypothesis test. Nothing to it. If you want to test the hypothesis that this treatment works 10 points better than this treatment, instead of testing for a mean difference of 0, you test for a mean difference of 10. Literally, add 10 to the smaller group. Add 10 to the score of everybody in a smaller group. Throw it into the t-test. Boom! Or F. It's there. The problem isn't that you can't do the statistic. The problem is that as a group, we are unwilling to get off our chicken asses and pick an effect pick a mean difference big enough to convince us. You see it most often when the economics is attached to the statistics. For example, somebody comes in and says, mine's better than what you're doing right now. And somebody does the numbers and they say, tell you what, if you can give me a 15% improvement, it's economically worth it to me. So don't test the nil null, test the 15% null. With me? It's right there. It's easy to do. The problem isn't the math. The problem is we're unwilling to pick a non-nil null. But if you ever want to, let me know. I do a lot of non-nil nulls because I do a lot of things where after, when we're deciding whether something matters or not, is economic, and you can tell me how much an improvement you need to be interested. I can test that null. Nothing to it. Maybe the best thing that came out of this whole push against significance testing was meta-analysis. The idea that we rejected the critical experiment centuries ago. Because we aren't good about we say it. Hell, it's in every book. It's on every test. It's not in our hearts. We still look at one thing and go, meh. We look at two things and go, oh, shit. Let the evidence stack up. Summarize the evidence. Argue about that. That's basically what the meta-analyst said. It's a process of comparing and or combining effects of multiple studies to get a more precise estimate of effect sizes and the likelihood of type 1 and type 2 errors. Meta-analysts need good information about the research they are examining and summarizing, which has led to some changes about what journals ask you to report. Like, I don't just want means, I want standard deviations. I don't just want the total N, I want the sample size for each group. I want exact p-values, not the old greater than, less than, 0.05, 0.01, 0.001. I want the mean square error for ordinary least squares and ANOVA models. And god damn it, I want effect sizes. So I can start there and do a meta-analysis. Most of these don't look surprising to you because all of this started seriously about 20 years ago and has sort of continued. Every journal that I know asks for all of these except for the effect sizes. And it's good because there's more information available to the reader. The results section, remember this both when you're reading and when you're writing, the results section should not be a black box. There were data. Let's talk about what the results mean. Well, there were results too. And they were arrived at by a process that you should elucidate, and you made decisions based on results, and you should present your results so that the reader can agree with you or not, as opposed to forced to believe you. By the way, it was the meta-analysis folks who really started the fussing about type 2 errors caused by lower power, finding that there was evidence of effects, but nulls were often retained because the sample sizes were too small. When you take those four studies that all found a 0.4 and put them into a meta-analysis, typically the p-value for the overall estimate is around zero. Small studies need to have a way of stacking up to let us know that those small studies found consistent results. And that's why the last thing we do before we go home for winter break is meta-analysis.